All right, so did everyone remember to take the quiz on time?
Good deal.
That usually I will post it earlier in the week. It was only because I was out of state, like I said. But I don't know how much difference that'll make anyway, because I could post them all right now, and still the vast majority of people are going to wait until Tuesday or Wednesday morning to do them. So I don't think you were too time stressed, were you, by having it a little bit later than usual this time? Hopefully not. But the next one will be up maybe tomorrow. Depends on when I get it written. Anyway, on to today's stuff. The topic for today, of course, is pertinent to ecology, but not just ecology. In fact, not even just biology as a huge science. It's really pertinent to all of science. And what is the topic I'm talking about? No, I don't mean specifically what we're doing. I mean, what we're doing is just an example of the topic. What is the main idea today? What do we want to talk about? The general theme. Hypothesis testing, yes. So let's actually start very basic. And without delving too deeply into philosophy, let's distinguish between science and faith to begin with. What is the difference? Who wants to tell me what the difference between science and faith is? There's a fundamental difference between the two. No stabs?
Like science is like facts, right? And like faith is like...
Science isn't necessarily facts. A fact is kind of a tricky word. We can't really say that we know anything for absolute certainty. So, I'm going to reject that. But I'm glad you had the guts to say something. What were you going to say? I mean, in terms of the difference between science and faith. Faith is belief. Science is belief. So they're similar in that respect. But faith is belief in something in the absence of evidence. And in fact, sometimes even despite evidence to the contrary. Whereas science is belief in something based on evidence. There has to be evidence for it to be science. And that is the fundamental difference. So you can believe something, but if you believe something without actually having evidence for it, or despite evidence to the contrary, then you're not acting scientifically. That brings up the tricky question of what evidence is. How do you determine whether or not there actually is evidence for something? Sometimes it's obvious, like something is there or it's not. You know, you can sense it, you can see it, smell it, taste it, feel it, whatever, measure it somehow. Sometimes it's not. It's more subtle, and that's exactly why we need to have objectivity in science. It's not just up to the scientist to say, well, yeah, this is evidence, or no, this isn't. Instead, we want to divorce ourselves from the process and let math take over, basically, to put it out of our hands so that we are not biasing the decision as to whether or not that evidence exists. That's what hypothesis testing is really all about, right? And so hypothesis testing is a way of using statistics to determine whether actually there is whether what we say the null hypothesis is true, or whether an alternative hypothesis is true. So hypothesis testing distills it all down to the process of saying yes or no, basically, based on a number. which that number, that statistic, of course, comes from the data that are obtained. And by the way, data, the word data, is plural. So it should be used with plural nouns. We should say the data are, or the data do. But only purists do that. Data is just the plural of datum, right? Anyway, we'll see whether the data we obtain are significantly different from another batch of data. That's what we basically do in hypothesis testing. Let's look at some of the highlights of the thing you read, just to make sure we have all these definitions down. Now, the actual procedure doesn't matter to today. This seed pod thing, which we can do, we don't have to do it. There's other choices we have. It's just a way of using statistical analysis, hypothesis testing. But the part that comes after the introduction, these are the things that you should know the definitions of. And I'm sure you're familiar with these descriptive statistics. Usually you calculate the mean much more often than you calculate median or mode. But does anyone have any difficulty distinguishing medians and modes, how they are different? Okay, well then I'm not even going to bother going through that. You can read that. What is central tendency? Central tendency, yeah, is just the category that all of those belong to. Mean, median, mode, those are all measures of central tendency. In other words, where does the center of the data tend to be? That's central tendency. And each of the, even though those measures are different from each other, they're all in one way or another a measure of central tendency. That's different from distribution of the data, which is most easily seen just by looking at these graphs. Right? How the data are distributed when you obtain a lot of data can be different depending on the nature of the data. As it says here, you rarely in biology get a uniform distribution, but that would simply mean that in a histogram, which is the graph of frequency versus measurement, you would have just about as many examples from each category as any other category, right? But nature doesn't usually work that way, right? You don't have just as many extremely small or extremely big organisms within a population as you do average-sized individuals. So you rarely see uniform distribution. Instead, you see either a nice normal distribution like the standard bell curve, and bell curves, you know, are the typical shape of a histogram for grades, right, in a class. It's not always a nice perfect bell curve. It's not always an indication of perfect normality, that shape exactly. What is the main reason that you would get deviation from normality in a histogram of grades for a class? Well, yeah, you can have outliers, certainly, and those would affect the distribution, but what would be the major reason why you wouldn't get a nice perfect bell curve? Or thinking of it the other way around, how could you get closer and closer to a bell curve in a class? Exactly. The bigger a class you have, the more likely it is to be a nice symmetrical bell curve. If you have a small class, which basically all of them here are, you're not necessarily going to see that. And that's because you're really just taking a small sample size, as you said. And this is an important distinction. In biology, we almost never, if not never, measure an entire population. Instead, we do sampling. We take a sample and we assume that they represent the overall population, even though we are ignoring most of the individuals of that population. And by population here, it doesn't necessarily mean organisms, right? Population is just simply a group of things that you can measure. Well, if you do field work, you don't go out and measure every instance of whatever you're measuring in the world or even in an ecosystem. Instead, you take samples, you randomly take samples, and you assume that they represent the entire population. And that's why there is a slight difference in the formulae for variance and standard deviation. We have what is called the population variance and the population standard deviation. Correspondingly, we have the sample variance and the sample standard deviation. What's the one that we use more often in biology? The sample standard deviation and the sample variance. What is the difference between the two in the formulae? Anyone know? Yeah. Well, that's true for both. That's true, but it's true for both sample and population. Oh, I think I misinterpreted you. I see what you're saying. You're saying the difference between standard deviation and variance is one being the square of the other.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, but that's actually also true of both population and sample. What I'm saying is if you just choose one of those, choose standard deviation, which is the square root of variance, right? The population standard deviation formula has one difference compared to the sample standard deviation. What is that difference? What did you say? That's exactly the difference. Right. If you measure the entire population, you would use N in your divisor in that formula, which we almost never do because we don't actually measure everything in the population. When you're taking a sample of the population, then you use N minus 1 that you're dividing things by. Right? Now notice N minus 1 is smaller than N, of course, right? What does that do to the variance if you divide by N minus 1 instead of N? It makes it larger. When you divide by a smaller number, the quotient, the answer, is larger. So that makes sense. That makes common sense, hopefully, right? If you're only sampling the population rather than measuring every individual, then you would expect there to be greater variety or variance in your data. That makes sense? Okay, well, standard deviation and variance are not actually measures of distribution, which is what these graphs illustrate. They are really measures of dispersion of the data. So the distribution refers to the shape of the curve, how many humps it has, whereas the dispersion refers to how steep, how pointed the peaks are, or the peak. Right? If you have a narrow dispersion, that means that most of the data are very close to that mean, one side or the other, and therefore it's a tall peak. If you have a very flat, rounded peak, then that's a wide dispersion, which corresponds to a large variance or a large standard deviation. All right, so the sample standard deviation formula is given there, but that's likely different from sample standard deviation formulae that you've used in other courses. Is that true for anyone? Is this different from the one that you've already learned? Yeah, it is mathematically equivalent. But what is the one that you learned? With the what? Correct. Correct. Another way of writing that would be that S equals the square root of the sum from 1 to n of the quantity x minus x vinculum. What is x vinculum? What is a vinculum? Vinculum is the name for the bar that you put over. Right? I guess you could call it x bar. I prefer x vinculum. But what is x vinculum? How's that different from x? X is a measurement you make. Right. X vinculum or x bar is the mean that you calculate. The mean of the however many data you have. So for each individual datum, you subtract the mean from it. That itself is a deviation, right? You square that, and that's the squared deviation. You sum all of those squared deviations together, and then you divide that sum, if this is a sample that you're doing, rather than population, by n minus 1. Okay? Why do we square it? Why not just have the deviation, rather than the squared deviation? Yeah. That's exactly right. Squaring a number forces it to be non-negative. Non-negative simply means it's zero or positive, right? We don't want negative deviations in our sum because they can negate positive deviations of the same size, right? For instance, if I have three data, 1, 2, and 3, what is the mean? 2. So for the first measurement, 1 minus the mean is 1 minus 2. That's negative 1. Okay, keep that in mind. The second one is 2 minus 2, which is 0. The third one is 3 minus 2, which is positive 1. When you add those up, you get negative 1 plus 0 plus 1, which is 0. Which tells you that there isn't any variance at all in those data, which you know is a lie because they're not the same data, right? They are different from each other. You don't want the negative deviation to outdo or undo the positive deviation. So instead, you square them all. Zeros squared are still zeros, so they don't contribute as they shouldn't. But anything other than zero does contribute to the sum. And therefore, if you did the squares of those instead, you would get negative 1 squared, which is 1, plus 0 squared, which is 0, plus 1 squared, which is 1, an overall of 2, and then you would divide that by n minus 1, which is 2 itself. That's 1. The square root of 1 is what? Close. Right. The square root of 1 is plus or minus 1, but we always use the positive square root. For the standard deviation, because it doesn't make sense to say a negative deviation, right? Okay. Everyone clear on all that? So feel free to use that formula if you want, but if you're already comfortable with the one that is the sum of the deviations squared divided by n minus 1 and then the square root of that, feel free. So S itself stands for standard deviation. What symbol do we use for variance? S squared. And this is one way of keeping track of which one is the square root of the other. If you remember that S, as the initial implies, stands for standard deviation, S squared is the other one. And that symbology, the fact that it's S squared versus just S, tells you that the variance is the standard deviation squared, and conversely, standard deviation is the square root of variance. Okay? Then let's just quickly talk about hypothesis testing. As you see in the introduction, or in the background information, when we use the word hypothesis, we use it differently in different situations. You're used to thinking of the word hypothesis as being part of the scientific method, right? In hypothesis testing, we're not actually directly testing the scientific hypothesis, the experimental hypothesis. Really what we're doing is testing whether or not what we call the null hypothesis is true. And the null hypothesis is simply a phrase we use to describe the situation in which two batches of data do not differ from each other. That's what the null hypothesis says. There is really no difference between these two batches of data. Okay? But we do that because those data represent the real hypothesis that we're testing, the scientific hypothesis. And by the way, you should have learned about the scientific method in grade school, and again in high school, and again in 181, several times throughout your lifetime by now. But I continue to be astounded by how many people confuse hypothesis and prediction. So let's spend a couple moments distinguishing them. What's the difference between a hypothesis and a prediction? They're related, but how do you identify a hypothesis versus a prediction? Yeah. Correct. That's a way of linguistically knowing that you have a prediction. If you have future tense, but predictions are. Yeah, they're typically written in if-then fashion. But a prediction is just that. A prediction says what will happen, assuming that a hypothesis is true. A hypothesis, on the other hand, is an explanation. And of course, it doesn't have to be correct at all. That's the whole idea of hypothesis testing. And science in general is to see whether a hypothesis that you've come up with can be supported or not, right? But the wording of a hypothesis should be descriptive. You know, if you think about the overall scientific method, which, you know, scientists don't do as a checklist to make sure they do it in the order that you learned it in grade school, but really they are doing it in that order, just not according to some set plan. The first thing that you have in the scientific method, though, is what? What does science start with? Observation, exactly. We notice things. We notice things about the universe. They interest us, because we're curious animals, right? So those observations lead to questions, right? Why is this the way it is? Well, hypothesis is simply an answer to that question. So a hypothesis is an explanation of an observation. And therefore, generally speaking, a hypothesis should have the form of a sentence like, this observation, whatever the observation is, because, and then an explanation of why it is that way. Right? Doesn't say what will happen, that's a prediction. A hypothesis is written in a declarative sentence. It assumes that it is true. Right? You put forth a hypothesis as though it is true, because the whole idea is to test whether or not it's true, but you put it forth as though assuming that it's true. In the next step of the scientific method, though, that hypothesis leads logically to a prediction. In other words, the prediction simply assumes that the hypothesis is true, and it will tell you what should happen if that hypothesis actually is true. Right? And that's why you have an if-then statement typically for a prediction. If hypothesis, then this is going to happen. All that leaves is actually going through with testing it, right? Which is the experiment itself. So you set up an experiment that will test that prediction, basically. Test whether or not that prediction will come true. You set it up, run it, collect data, and you see whether the prediction actually did come true. What happens if it does come true? Correct. Then your hypothesis is supported. Does not mean it's proven. We actually never prove hypotheses, which is why I said earlier we don't truly know anything. But we can be pretty damn sure of some things, because if we continue to test it and it always comes true, those are the things that we call facts. Now, sometimes what we call facts will change. You know, this happens every so often in science. Like when we used to say what Newton told us is the truth, well, that actually ends up being wrong, right? We had to scrap Newtonian physics, even though it's useful in the macroscopic world because it's close enough. But really, we replaced that with quantum physics, right? Because when you get down to very small scales, Newtonian physics breaks down. So that's the name. That's, by the way, another difference between science and faith. If science does end up showing that a previously held belief is no longer supported, then you can't just hang on to that belief. You can hang on to a belief as long as you want in faith. But to act scientifically, you have to say, well, we were wrong. This is now what we're calling the truth. Okay? But anyway, that's the big difference between the use of the word hypothesis when we talk about null or alternative in hypothesis testing. Those are not... The null hypothesis always simply means these two batches of data don't differ. Whereas the alternative hypothesis says there is some difference between these batches of data. And that's all we're really doing directly in a scientific hypothesis test using statistics. But because those data come from the experiment that we set up to actually test the scientific hypothesis, whatever it is, then we can use the rejection of the null hypothesis, if the test warrants the rejection of the null hypothesis, to say in our specific scientific experiment that the hypothesis we're trying to test is actually supported. Okay? Does all that make sense? All right, now, I like... Well, actually, before I get to that, let's quickly make sure you understand the difference between type 1 and type 2 errors, in case it's not obvious from the reading. Of course, we don't want any errors, ideally, but it's possible to make an error in hypothesis testing, and there are two fundamentally different types of errors, right? Type 1 error and type 2 error are might be difficult to remember which is which, but I base it on whether or not the null hypothesis is actually true. So a type 1 error is an error in which the null hypothesis is actually true, which means the two batches of data really are not different from each other. But we're rejecting that null hypothesis because we think they're different. That's a type 1 error. Okay? What that means is we say that there is some statistical difference between these batches of data when actually there really isn't. That's the converse of a type 2. In a type 2, there really is no difference. I mean, there is a difference in the two batches of data. The null hypothesis is false, in other words. The alternative hypothesis is actually true, but we accept the null hypothesis because we don't recognize that difference in the data. And like I said, either you don't want to make either kind of error, of course, but what is the better error to make if you have to make one of the two? It's better to make the type 2 error, because that really just sends you back to the drawing board scientifically. If there actually is a difference, you know, there is some effect of your treatment, but you just don't recognize it. That a very easy way for that to happen is you simply haven't tested enough subjects. Your sample size is too low. And that's why sample size is taken into account in these statistics. It gets harder to reach that critical value when you have a lower sample size. That's built into the formulae that these tests are using. So there might actually be a difference, but you only tested two individuals. Very low sample size. So mathematically, it's going to tell you these aren't statistically different. Okay, well, that's a type 2 error. But the reason that is not so bad is because you're not really lying to the scientific world. You're just, you haven't completed the work, really, right? If you go back in there and dig deeper, increase your sample size, do things more carefully, repeat the process, it's likely that you will actually have a statistically significant difference, which means that you would reject the null hypothesis, as you should, since it's truly false. Okay? On the other hand, you don't want to accept the alternative hypothesis, or reject the null hypothesis, in other words, if the null hypothesis is actually true. If there's really no difference, you're saying there is an effect here when there really isn't. That looks worse scientifically. So you want to avoid that more so than a type 2. And that's the whole reason why these various statistical tests are just really a way of computing the probability of making a type 1 error. Right? When you read literature, you're often, when you read the results section, which is the hardest section to read, it's the least enjoyable part of any scientific paper to read. But you'll see p-values in there, right? There can be different kinds of tests depending on what the experiment is. Often they're ANOVAs, but not always. You know, you have t-tests and all kinds of things. But they all boil down to whether or not you get below a certain, the p-value is below a certain critical value, right? What do we call, what symbol do we use for that critical value of p? Alpha, exactly. So alpha, well, first of all, what is p? It's what? It is a probability, and that's why it is p, but it's the probability of what? In any given test, p is the same thing. P is the probability of committing a type 1 error. Okay, what that means is it tells you how probable it is that you are rejecting the null hypothesis when it's actually true. Okay, in other words, it's the probability that you're saying there really is an effect when there isn't. Which is the thing you don't want to happen, right? Even more than a type 2. So, we want to keep that very low. We want there to be a very low probability that we're committing a type 1 error. If we're saying that there is really an effect of the experiment, we actually want there to be an effect. So we want to keep that probability low, and we're, you know, if we set alpha at 5% or 0.05, then that means there's a 95% chance that we're right if we reject the null hypothesis, which is pretty acceptable. Now, it's not universal. You know, there's nothing magic about 5%. Really, your alpha should be set for any given experiment based on the experiment itself, on how well you're able to control the controlled variables that shouldn't be part of the experiment, you know, how precisely and accurately you can make measurements, which differs from experiment to experiment, from science to science. So you're really supposed to take all these things into consideration when you set your alpha. But in practice, just about all scientists, but especially biologists, just kind of arbitrarily as a community say, let's set this at 5%. Sometimes, you know, they'll set it lower. You almost never see it set higher. Making it set lower means you're even more sure that you're not committing a type 1 error, right? If you say it's significant below 5%. But But alpha is a constant. It's set. It's the maximum allowable probability of committing a type 1 error that you will accept. And your goal, if you're really trying to show that the null hypothesis is rejected, in other words, that there is an effect, is to get a p-value that's lower than alpha. A p-value lower than alpha means that there is fewer than 5% chance that you're calling this an effect when there actually isn't one. Okay? Now, where do you get the p-value? Well, the p-value comes from the actual test, and each test has its own formula, and you're not going to memorize these formulae, but you have to pick the appropriate test depending on the nature of your data and what you're testing. But it really all boils down to any given test is going to calculate some statistic, which if you're using a t-test, for instance, which we'll use today, it would be called the t-statistic, or a chi-statistic if you're using a chi-square, and so on. That statistic is basically a cutoff point. There is a critical value corresponding to the alpha that the test statistic is either above or below. Okay? So your choice of alpha determines some cutoff value that the statistic is going to determine the difference between significance and non-significance. Okay? And that is most easily seen as a value of p. Rather than using the statistic itself, which can be big or small depending on the test, you don't really have a feel for that, you normalize all these tests by distilling it down into a p-value. And then all you really have to care about is that your p is less than what your acceptable alpha is, which is almost always 0.05. Okay? So p less than 0.05, we say the null hypothesis is not true. There actually is a difference between these two data sets. And therefore, there is an effect of whatever treatment you're testing. The treatment is simply whatever you're doing in the experiment, right? Okay. So then let's look at this next page, which is a simplified or an incomplete version of the flow chart that's on the page after this. But this one is nice to use. This is set up as a series of questions, basically. Each question has two answers. What do we call this kind of key? This one is, the specific example here is to determine what kind of test you're supposed to use. But this is also used as an identification key, for instance. If you collect some specimen from the wild, you ask yourself an initial question. It's either yes or no, or one answer or the other, nothing in between. And depending on that answer, then you go to another question, right? For instance, if you collect an organism, a first question could be, does it produce milk? Yes, if the answer is yes, okay, you have a mammal. Go on to the questions that assume you have a mammal. If not, you don't have a mammal, right? What kind of key is that called? Till after you go through a series of questions, you specifically pin down what type of organism you have. It's called a dichotomous key. Because a dichotomy is a two-part thing, right? So each question has exactly two answers, and you have to be one answer or the other. So this is set up as a dichotomous key, which is useful. Don't overlook this just as something that you care about today only. This can actually be useful when you're trying to figure out what is the appropriate statistical test to run. So are you making measurements or just counts? Simple counts, you skip all this stuff and go right down to here. Do you know what the expected outcome is? Well, no, if you don't, then you would use a chi-square contingency. But if you do know what the expected is all it is. You would use chi-square goodness of fit. Now, many of you, maybe even all of you, have, or at least should have, used a chi-square goodness of fit in another class. As my students, for many of you, what class am I talking about? In what? Yes, in LSC 348, you should have used a chi-square goodness of fit test in your fly experiments, right? Why is it that we knew what the predictions were in that example? We counted flies of various categories, right? So that's why we're in chi-square, because we're making simple counts. But why is it that we knew how many of each category there should be? Punnett squares, exactly. So that was an example in which you knew what the predicted values were, and you were just testing whether they matched them. Sometimes you don't have any idea what the prediction should be, in which case instead you should use a chi-square contingency test. But you see how the dichotomous key works. Most of the time, we don't have simple counts. We have measurements of some type. Mass, height, whatever. And so we have to go to the appropriate place. Okay, so that's how you use this thing. But it really is just another way of looking at some of the material that's in the more complicated flowchart. The flowchart includes more because everything in that dichotomous key really assumed that we had parametric that we had normal data, which means that we use parametric tests. Parametric tests are for normally distributed data. Not all data is actually normally distributed, though. So if you use a parametric test for non-normal data, you're committing a statistical error. You should be using a different kind of test. But this is also a dichotomous key, because each box is really a decision, yes or no. Depending on the answer, you go somewhere else. Okay. The dichotomous key on the previous page, though, doesn't include anything about non-parametric tests. And we're not going to conduct any non-parametric tests in here. I just wanted to let you know that that's what they are. You shouldn't even try to conduct any non-parametric tests until you've done enough hypothesis testing to be comfortable with more basic statistics. All right, so those are the salient points for the day. The rest of it is really just a matter of collecting data. And, of course, this all leads to your handing in the worksheet next time. And the worksheet is set up for using the seed pods, which we have some of. We don't have, first of all, I don't know how many of these are Udo's seed pods, and to do the experiment, we have to destroy them because we have to open them up and weigh the seeds. So I don't know whether that's just ones he gave me and I can use all of them, or whether he's supposed to have some of those either. But also, that's not all that many combined, so if we dole those out to everyone, we don't really get a huge sample size. What I'm saying is that you can use these if you want, but you don't have to do this. You can do the worksheet for some other question as well. As long as you're doing a t-test, which is going, when do we use a t-test? We use a t-test if we're trying to compare the means between two samples in which we make measurements, right? Not counts, not just simple counts. And so that's appropriate for the seed pod thing, because we're actually supposed to be measuring the mass, we're weighing them, in other words, for each seed. What's the treatment, though? If you use this as your test, you would be making individual measurements of the mass of individual seeds, one by one. But what is the treatment? What are the two treatment classes? The individual measurements of individual seeds are just different samples, right? What are the two treatment classes? Exactly. Those are the two categories. Seeds that came from a pod containing just one seed compared to seeds that came from a pod containing more than one seed. All right, so there are two categories there, two treatment classes. And then we have however many individual samples in each category. Those are measurements, not just counts. So it calls for a t-test. But notice there are two types of t-tests, right? Unpaired and paired. Is this unpaired or paired if we, in this example of pea pods? Seed pods. It is not paired. In paired, you would make the same measurement under two conditions on the same subject. For instance, in my doctoral research, I measured rate of evaporation from birds. And I would use the same individual with evaporation occurring without any hindrance. And then at a later date, I put that same individual in and measured the evaporation when the cloaca was glued shut. So it could evaporate from anywhere except its cloaca. That would be a paired t-test because, you know, I'm comparing one bird to the same bird under a different situation. Here, you're not matching up pea pods, right? Or you're not measuring the same pea pod under two different situations. So it would be an unpaired t-test. But you don't have to use these, or I keep saying pea pods, seed pods. You don't have to do this. I mean, for instance, you could have as your two categories male versus female humans, which we have examples of both here, right? Just to make it physiological, you could measure, you could see whether there is a difference in the change in blood pressure after holding breath for 1 minute in males versus females. Right, the two treatment categories would be male and female, analogous to one seed pod or multiple seed pod. But in this case, each individual datum would require two actual measurements, right? Because I said change in. You need to delta, you have to have two measurements. So you take your blood pressure before, hold your breath for a minute, take the blood pressure again. Whatever that difference is, that's your number. Okay? You'd have that for so many men, for so many women, and then you can run the t-test. So we could do that and not even destroy any of Udo's property. I just would have to go down and get a couple manometers. Are anyone interested in doing that? Also, it might be quicker. Okay, well, I'm going to shut the recording off anyway.